We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
This is Multipolarity, charting the rise of the new multipolar world order.
Coming up this week,
a diplomatic incident in Latin America has somehow become the focal point for an ever-expanding range of stories, from Venezuelan elections to US energy policy to Ecuadorian banana exports to Russia, leading even cool-headed observers to ponder the question, are we approaching the Latin American embassy incident singularity?
Meanwhile, there are always good tariffs and bad tariffs, and in announcing his new shipbuilding policies, this week, Joe Biden's given us both a plate of cheese and a plate of chalk.
Finally, arch-Eurocrat Mario Draghi has made a big speech about European competitiveness, its 20 years of failure, and its hope for the future. Is this the first sign of a continent about to flex its soon-to-be enviable muscles? Or is it the first twitchings of an arthritic bodybuilder about to pop a hernia?
But first,
Bananageddon.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit of action in Latin America over the past few weeks. Certainly seems like the multipolar developments are hitting the continent pretty hard, not in a kind of a chaotic way that we see in the Middle East or in Central and Eastern Europe, and potentially even in South China Sea, but in this kind of, you know, almost, very minor but indicatively chaotic event. So it was about a week or two ago, an Ecuadorian politician, I think he may have been the ex-vice president, sought asylum in the Mexican embassy. And in response to this, the Ecuadorian security services, I guess, raided the embassy. And there was some quite rough scenes on Twitter, on video and so on. I think I heard that the ambassador might have been roughed up or something like that. Anyway, this is obviously a violation of Mexican territorial sovereignty. It's actually quite a serious diplomatic breach. It got some coverage, but not much, probably because Ecuador, the current government of Ecuador, is quite aligned with the West. Anyway, the Venezuelans and the Hondurans have basically turned around and said that they want to punish, I suppose, Ecuador for this. They want to cut off diplomatic ties and so on. And cutting off diplomatic ties in a situation like this is pretty normal, I'd say. You know, Ecuador did violate a sovereign territory of a country, an embassy. That's kind of a big deal. In response to this, the Biden White House has said that they are going to reimpose the oil sanctions on Venezuela. Now, immediately when I saw this, I thought it was very strange. We talked about it on the show before, but basically what happened with those oil sanctions is Venezuela was sanctioned for a long time because it was seen as a kind of a rogue state and so on. And I think it was last year the Biden administration basically lifted those sanctions on Venezuela. And the reason was quite simple. The Biden administration and everybody really realized that the dependable Western or U.S. control over global oil markets was lost when the tight relationship with Saudi Arabia was broken. That's been a long time coming. We've talked about it on the show before, but the too long read version is the Ukraine war ushered in a new period of kind of multipolar development, and Saudi Arabia saw other ways to go with the Chinese. They joined the BRICS, et cetera, et cetera. And they, along with the Russians, now basically control swing production in OPEC Plus. So America basically scrambled around looking for any other middle-sized oil producer to try and get them to turn on the taps. Venezuela was one. They cut a deal with them. I don't know exactly what it entailed, but part of it was, we'll take the oil sanctions off. And of course, they'll need the oil sanctions off in order to buy the oil. I'm sure there was other components to that deal too. Anyway, so Biden is now turning around, and in the run-up to the election, with oil prices rising, he's saying, well, we're going to impose the oil sanctions again over this diplomatic fracas with Ecuador. Seemed unlikely. So I was looking into it a bit more. And actually, prior to that, the Biden White House was threatening to reimpose the oil sanctions unless Venezuela engaged in free and fair elections, I think, next year. So, you know, I mean, if you're a really idealistic person, you might say, oh, well, you know, the Biden administration has stopped being cynical and stopped kind of trading oil sanctions against the election and the oil price. Okay, sure. No, not really. The Biden administration clearly has made a decision that they want to reimpose the oil sanctions on Venezuela. And this probably has nothing to do with Ecuadorian embassies, and it also probably has nothing to do with free and fair elections in Venezuela. It looks like the rumor going around is that the Biden administration wants to reimpose these Venezuelan sanctions as an excuse to tap the strategic petroleum reserve in the run-up to the election. Bloomberg reports U.S. actions would be taken to ease the impact of the Venezuelan sanctions on Americans and the U.S. oil market. Another quote from John Podesta, this is all covered in Zero Hedge. John Podesta, who's obviously a White House senior advisor, worked on the Clinton campaign, he's quite well known. He said the president did it, i.e. release oil from the SBR before, and I think he wants to keep the price of gasoline affordable, and he will do what he can to make sure that happens. So clearly what's happening here is Biden wants to tap the SPR before the election because oil prices are rising. That's really controversial because of all the presidents in recent history, Biden has been the most irresponsible with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is supposed to be there for emergency use only, wartime, you know, natural disaster, something like that. And you can also point out right now, we have one of the most unstable world environments in memory. So having the Strategic Petroleum Reserve on hand could actually be very important. But the Biden administration, because they really have proved to be this reckless bunch of clowns, frankly, have tapped the SPR over and over again to try and get their poll numbers up. Well, it looks like they're about to tap it again. And the reason that they're going to give to the public is Venezuela. There's a baddie out there. He's done bad things. We're going to clamp down on him with sanctions because we're goodies. And then we're going to turn on the SPR. Is anyone going to buy this? Not a chance.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about this story in general is that it's playing against a backdrop of geopolitical changes within Latin America. We've spoken several times on this podcast about the way that China is now the major trading partner of almost every, I think in fact every country in Latin America, from the Rio Grande down to the southern tip of Argentina, except one, I forget which that one country is, but it might in fact be Mexico because it's trading with the US. Anyway, the US is very clearly entering an era of security competition, great power security competition with the Chinese. You know, Latin America has always been the US's backyard. They've had the Monroe Doctrine, which forbids the involvement of any outside great power in the Western Hemisphere, i.e. that part of the globe which covers the Americas. And it's used the Monroe Doctrine frequently over the years as essentially a catch-all to as an excuse to be able to interfere either militarily on a great many occasions, but also in the internal politics and workings of individual countries for well over a century now. And now that China is emerging as the major trading and economic partner of a lot of these countries and is obviously gaining a great deal of influence there, the US is starting to become more active in its own backyard again, so to speak. So let's have a look at some of the background here. As you mentioned, there was the embassy raid on, I think, it was the first week of April anyway. So I had this embassy raid. But before that, let's go back to January. The beginning of January, there was prison riots in Ecuador. It's one of these countries that is benighted by organized crime related to drug cartels. And as people know, because of the El Salvador situation and President Bukele there, it's a really serious problem in this part of the world. And Ecuador has a very similar situation to pre-Bukele El Salvador. So there's prison riots. And on January the 8th, the new president, Daniel Noboa, who, by the way, was born in the United States and raised in the United States and went to university in the United States and postgrad university in the United States. I mean, he's very connected to the US by birth, by upbringing, and by education. And he's now the younger, I think maybe the youngest ever president of Ecuador. But anyway, he declared a state of emergency. And it looked very much as though he was going to embark on a kind of Bukele-style attack on the cartels within the country. He declared a state of emergency. He declared these organizations terrorists. He declared them to be non-combatants. It was very kind of war on terror language that he used. Now, the day after that, armed men connected with the cartels, people remember shocking scenes, stormed a television station, held TV presenters at gunpoint on live TV, which, you know, made the situation even worse and made Noboa double down. And the very next day after that, the US said that they would be willing to help Noboa with his efforts to tackle the drug cartels. It was in both of their national interests to do that. And they opened the way for further military cooperation between the two countries. Now, keep in the back of your mind here that the US wants to increase its military presence in the region to combat the growing influence of China in that area. Now, we've had a situation where it has an opening to expand its military presence by cooperation with Ecuador on drug issues. The very next day after that, Noboa agreed that he would deliver Russian military equipment that Ecuador had bought off Russia to the United States. It would send that military equipment to the United States, shells, armored personnel carriers. I don't know exactly what was there, but the exchange was $200 million worth of new U.S. weaponry at a future date to help with Noboa's war on the drug cartels, basically. Now, everybody understood where those weapons were going for. Like, the Americans certainly didn't want Russian weapons. They were going to send them to Ukraine. Obviously, that annoyed Russia, which said, look, we signed an agreement with you in 2008, in which you were forbidden from reselling or passing on this equipment to anybody else who we didn't agree with in a prior agreement. So, no, you can't do that, and you're in violation. And Russia then threatened and actually took steps to block Ecuadorian banana exports and flour exports. Now, Ecuador is, you know, it's not a big country. It only has a few industries. But one of them, I know this, I don't know if this is appropriate, but does everyone know where the word banana republic comes from? Well, it's those Central American and Latin American nations. For Ecuador, bananas are a key export. So Russia threatened to block those bananas. And then eventually, as far as I understood, I've been following this on some excellent reports on the Naked Capitalism website. Apparently, the Ecuadorians backed down because the Russians threatened to block imports of Ecuadorian bananas and imports of Ecuadorian flowers. And the Ecuadorians backed down. Basically, the Russians got their way and these weapons weren't going there. So all of this happens against a backdrop of increasing ties between the U.S. and Ecuador, and an attempt to deepen military ties between the two nations. At the same time that the U.S. is deepening ties with Argentina through Milei, also with Peru, which is another country who has invited the U.S. in militarily to help with the drug cartels, which suits the U.S. very well. And then Ecuador went and raided a foreign embassy, the Mexican embassy in Quito, the Ecuadorian capital. You know, it sent like a SWAT team in there to go and grab Jorge Glass, who was the former vice president, indicted and found guilty on corruption charges. And they claimed that it was part of the effort to, you know, crack down on corruption. But, I mean, it was a violation directly of the Vienna Conventions on Diplomatic Relations of 1961. And this is something that you just don't do. I mean, quite often embassies will be attacked, at various levels, often by angry people with, say, a Molotov cocktail, or, you know, people will throw bricks out windows or something. But a state actually going in there and raiding a foreign embassy because somebody or something is in there that they want is such a huge no-no. And the US response to that was really very muted. Tony Blinken released a statement that said that they'd reviewed video footage and they believed that Ecuador was in violation. But that was it. That was it. They said, we believe that Ecuador broke international law. But there was no condemnation beyond that. You know, Biden didn't get up and say that this was an egregious and outrageous violation. No, nothing. And of course, as we've spoken before on this podcast, relations between the United States and Mexico under AMLO, the president there, haven't been the best recently. So against the background of that, Venezuela on Monday this week said that it was severing diplomatic ties with Ecuador. Nicaragua already had severed diplomatic ties, and Mexico had severed diplomatic ties with Ecuador. And now the US steps in and suddenly suggests that, you know, sanctions might be placed back on Venezuela at the same time that they're severing diplomatic ties with a country in Latin America with whom the US would like to be or is trying to get much closer to. It's a country that's a clear ally. It's very strange, but, you know, certainly the response of the US to the Ecuadorian raid on the Mexican embassy, I mean, I would have thought that they would make a bigger issue of it because, I mean, to be an ally with one country that attacks a diplomatic mission of another nation, you know, might be considered careless and they can get away with it. But two might suggest that you're not respecting the rules-based international order, right? And we've had Israel and Ecuador within days of each other. So this is part of, you know, I know you say that there's a domestic political explanation for this, which I don't doubt for one moment. I don't think it's too political for us to say that this presidential administration in America has been extraordinarily profligate and extraordinarily irresponsible with a lot of US strategic assets, whether it's their, you know, the amount of debt they're able to tap, or whether it's the strategic petroleum reserves, or whether it's the reserves of military materiel. There's been a lot of irresponsibility. But I also think it takes place against this backdrop of the shifting geopolitical relations in Latin and South America. And, you know, it's important to put this within that broader context.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the political angle, I mean, it's interesting to look at to get a kind of holistic picture of this. It's also kind of like clannishly funny, let's call it what it is. But when something like that is clannishly funny, you know, a president desperately trying to draw more oil out of the SPR to save his political bacon is kind of amusing. It also speaks to, you know, that's how bad decisions tend to be made. If you have somebody who's overrun with problems and you offer them a solution to their problem by packaging it into a package that would otherwise maybe be rejected or looked upon with more scrutiny, that can be quite poisonous in a sense. And I think you're getting at something there when you're talking about the kind of big global picture on this, that there's been two embassy violations in a very short period of each other by core allies of the United States, or at least allies of the United States, is very striking. I mean, look, I've always thought that the natural thing for America to do in the multipolar world is pivot back toward its own landmass where it's strong. And that would mean Latin America. I've kind of floated the idea maybe before of a neo-Monroe doctrine in some sense. Maybe not as, you know, nakedly imperial as the old Monroe Doctrine. Sorry, it is an imperial sort of program. Whether you approve of it or whether you disapprove of it, is it doesn't really matter. It is. And maybe a neo-Monroe Doctrine might be a little bit more work together-y or something like that. But I think the problem here is that if America turned around tomorrow and said, okay, look, the rest of the world, it's not going so well right now. We're going to have to let kind of regional powers balance it out. We can play a role, but it won't be a dominant role. Let's focus on our own backyard. Let's focus on Latin America. If they did that, if they made a clear decision to do that, and then did some things that were perhaps, shall we say, not above board, like look the other way when Ecuador violates an embassy, you know, slap Venezuela on the wrist to get kind of political support for some scheme to drain the SPR. Look, I think all that would be like forgivable in that circumstance. But it's what you just said. They haven't made a clear concerted effort to say we're pivoting away. We're going to probably, disengage, at least in a strong leadership role with other parts of the world. And we're going to focus on a leadership role on the American continent. They haven't done that. And so the dangerous thing about that is if you are seen to be not enabling, but looking the other way when norms are being violated, arbitrarily throwing around sanctions for domestic political policy gain, and at the same time, you're presenting yourself as a global leader, it doesn't really work. So I think what the Americans need to decide here, if they're going to kind of like get up to this sort of thing in Latin America, which maybe they need to be doing in some sense or other, maybe they do. But if they want to do that, they probably just have to focus. They have to focus. And if they're not willing to focus on that region, then it's probably kind of a bad idea to ignore transgressions and so on that continent while claiming to provide a global leadership role. Because frankly, people will just not take you seriously. They'll laugh at you. They'll make fun of you. People will go to diplomatic meetings and say, oh, the rules-based order. Yeah, rules for who, et cetera, et cetera. And it just feels to me like the kind of debacle that's going on in Latin America right now, if you read it in a global sense, it looks really, really bad. That said, could, in some strange way, provide a template for a more rational and focused foreign policy for the United States moving into the 21st century. That's being very optimistic.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
I think we've said on the show before, there are good tariffs and there are bad tariffs. I'm not personally hugely against tariffs, but I think you can kind of overuse them. I don't think they're a casual solution or anything like that. But used in a correct way, tariffs have always been a way for economic development and so on to take place. So given that context, the Biden administration, or Biden himself, I think actually in a speech in Pennsylvania, his hometown, I guess, on Wednesday called for some tariffs. Well, he called for some specific tariffs and then he called for some investigations. Let's talk about the specific tariffs first. Joe Biden, in front of a bunch of U.S. steel workers at their headquarters in Pittsburgh, which is part of the Rust Belt, the infamous Rust Belt that's been hollowed out by globalization. President Biden stood there and said that the U.S. should triple the existing tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminium imports. The existing tariff is 7.5%. So tripling that puts a very fat tariff on it. If the existing tariff was 1%, tripling it might not be too bad. But it's 7.5%. So tripling it, you're up to what, 22.5%. That's quite a large tariff. What do we say about a tariff like that? Look, this is the kind of tariff that I think in theory could do something. The US has a steel and aluminium industry. It's not particularly big right now, but they have one. And so if they impose tariffs on cheap Chinese steel and aluminium, there might be a substitution effect. Now, I don't know the details of it. There might not be. Tripling a tariff is big. You'd want to be very confident that you have the industrial capacity to turn on in a fairly short period of time, maybe 18 months or something like that. You'd probably want to look into that. Otherwise, you're going to substantially increase the price of steel by about, 13-14% here, and that's going to feed into all your input costs and create even more inflation in an already inflationary environment. So I think I'd be very generous to the Biden administration to say that they actually looked into that, made sure there was spare capacity, thought in detail about what tripling a tariff would be. Look, I've been watching these guys on the economy and especially on industrial policy since Biden got in. They're not particularly serious people. They don't seem to act in line with research. They don't seem to have a good economics advisory team, at least not on this sort of thing, industrial policy and so on. I think their general economics team is terrible. Yellen is not a good Treasury Secretary. I don't think anyone would actually disagree with me. Even Democrats probably don't. But the point is, in theory, that could have been a good tariff. That is the type of way that you could use a tariff if you are calibrating it correctly. Now, just to give some political context to that, Biden is actually trying to soften up the steelworkers here because there's a planned sale of U.S. steel to the Japanese-owned Nippon Steel. And this is very, very unpopular among U.S. steelworkers because they see it as kind of selling them out and selling them to a foreign company. I've talked to some people about the Nippon Steel deal. I don't think it's actually that bad. I think it could actually help improve and upgrade American steel production because their own steel production is just, they're not very good at it anymore. The Japanese are probably better at it, etc. But look, it doesn't really matter what I think on that front. Part of the reason here is Biden's going into election. He needs the unions on his side. A lot of these blue-collar workers, especially in purple states like Pennsylvania, do actually drift into the Trump camp, so he needs to give them something. He needs to give them a bit of sugar. that would make me again concerned about the calibration issue here and whether they're running it as a serious industrial policy or whether they're trying to do a sop to union members. Now, the second thing that was announced is actually in a way more interesting. Basically, Biden and the US trade representative, whose name is Catherine Tai, they have announced that they're launching an investigation into China's shipbuilding practices. So basically, this goes on the back of a petition put together by five labor unions saying that the shipbuilding that China's undertaking is in some way unfair. So I'll give you some of the language in the petition. Well, first of all, the U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said the petition presents serious and concerning allegations of China's longstanding efforts to dominate the maritime logistics and shipbuilding sectors, cataloging the People's Republic of China's use of unfair non-market policies and practices to achieve those goals, end quote. Not sure what to make of that. I'm sure the Chinese do want to dominate the shipping market. I'm sure everybody wants to dominate the shipping market. So, you know, you can always say that an industry is being unfair or it's being propped up or anything else. But at the end of the day here, obviously, the Americans, if the trade unions are signing onto this, have an idea in their head that by doing an investigation, launching a probe into the Chinese shipbuilding industry, they can get some sort of tariff on this. And then that can magically regrow the American shipbuilding industry, which frankly has gone to the dogs. It barely exists anymore. These are the kind of tariff policies that are pure fantasy. I called them magic beans on Twitter today because that's all they are. In theory, if you impose a tariff on the steel industry of another country, when you have a steel industry, you can build up production in a relatively acceptable time period. Not with this. Okay, America basically doesn't have a shipbuilding industry anymore, for all intents and purposes. I'm sure they still build some ships. I understand they're not very good or efficient at it, but they probably build a few. But they don't have a large-scale shipping industry. If you impose tariffs on an industry you don't have, you'll just raise the price of it. That's it. You'll just create inflation. It's as simple as that. I mean, in theory, I suppose you could come in and put a 200% tariff on the ships and make them completely unaffordable. And then at some point, your own shipbuilding industry would have to grind into gear. But even that would assume you have the engineering talent, you have the know-how, you have the, you know, various layers of expertise. You might not. So this is the kind of, this is the fantasy thinking with tariffs. And it strikes me, I think I said it in a response to someone on Twitter today, that basically what these types of tariffs, these magic beans thinking is, this complete nonsense that's floating around DC right now. It's lawyers, right? Lawyers who are focused on rules and how to govern based on rules and applying laws. It's lawyers trying to govern economic policy like lawyers and not having a clue what they're doing. Put the tariff in place and the rival industry just springs into being. This is what's being put in their head. Complete and utter nonsense.
I think I'll say four very brief things about this. The first is that it's important to notice here that for all the supposedly successful meeting between Xi and Biden in San Francisco, for all of, you know, Yellen's visits, for all of the restarting of bilateral relations at a kind of sub-administration level on matters like defense or the environment, it's clear that the relationship, well, the Sino-American relationship is still trending toward conflict. In this case, trade conflict. The US is still imposing more and more restrictions on China, whether it be the slow ratcheting up of chip restrictions and semiconductor restrictions, which are still being ratcheted up. By the way, recently the Americans tried to put more pressure on the South Koreans to abide by these. The South Koreans are resisting because for Samsung, China is a tremendously important market. But here we see with the steel industry as well, these sanctions are still being ratcheted up, and the trend is still moving in the direction toward full decoupling. And at present, I would say there is no sign that it's going to stop. So the only question is whether we're going to slowly and gradually over the course of decades move to a complete decoupling between the US and China, or whether it's going to reach a sudden point of no return and then suddenly break, snap, go, which would be really dangerous indeed. The second point I want to make about this is that it really flies in the face of the entire world order the US has built since the Cold War. During the Cold War, the US created a whole range of institutions to tie the Western world, its allies. So that's mainly Europe, but also countries like Australia, Japan, and South Korea into a world order that involved a series of sometimes overlapping and interlocking defense agreements, but also agreements on matters like trade, membership of the UN, the IMF, all of these institutions. The strategy after the Cold War was to extend those institutions, to bring in the rest of the world, essentially, to usher in the era of Pax Americana. In a way, its foreign policy has been dictated by that. Yet now, and by the way, I should say the US has criticized other countries hugely. It's tried to punish them severely if they, go against, general free trade orthodoxies, go against WTO rules, for example. But now we see the US is really very rapidly moving away from this. I mean, this might be a domestic political issue. As you quite rightly say, there's the big Nippon Steel takeover bid for US steel. Biden was giving a speech to, I believe, in Pittsburgh, which is a proper steel city. Wasn't that where, was that where the Deer Hunter was made? That's what always springs to mind when I hear stories of the US steel industry. Anyway, I might be wrong, but I thought it was kind of Appalachians, Pennsylvania, that sort of. Anyway, so there might be a domestic political aspect to this. Donald Trump for sure is going to go hard on trade. He's going to try and build up numbers among, the American working man, and especially the American working man who works in manufacturing and industry. And Biden might want to kind of try to outflank him on that a little bit, as often happens in elections. But what's important to note here is that it really, this policy, which seems now to be, bi-party consensus, essentially, it really flies in the face of everything that the US has tried to do in terms of trade, in terms of economics, since the end of the Cold War. The third thing I would say about this is that the reason for that is because the whole trading system in the world has become quite horribly dysfunctional. And the way that you can see that are the huge deficits that are being run by countries like the US and Great Britain, and the huge surpluses that until recently Germany was running, but also, most famously, China has been running. This is a kind of a sign, essentially, that the world trading system is grotesquely unbalanced and misformed, and ultimately it needs to move back into balance where there aren't countries with massive and chronic trade surpluses, maybe small trade surplus like 0.5% or 1% of GDP and equally a deficit, but not like 8% of GDP for the last 25 years. That's just way out of anything that could be considered reasonable. And ultimately, this will be reformed. It'll be reformed either by some kind of, horrific breakdown, as we saw in 1929 to 1933, or it'll be, go into kind of full trade war and perhaps actually hot economic war, as we saw in the early years of the 20th century. Or it'll be unwound in a very orderly way, where countries cooperate with each other and stop each other from deteriorating this system. That last option, ideal as it is not looking too likely at the moment. The final thing I would say about this is that the US is doing all this. It's running a huge industrial policy at the minute through the Inflation Reduction Act, which we've spoke about already, Philip. It's imposing tariffs left, right, and center. It is clearly, it also has the CHIPS Act, which is trying to get semiconductors. Do they really think that their allies are going to sit by and take this? How long before Europe, which is suffering its own economic issues at the moment, starts following the same route, or at least starts retaliating? How long can Europe afford just to sit there and take it? More, perhaps, in the next section. But on those four things, the direction of travel between in Sino-American relations, the second thing, the fact that it now appears to be direct US policy, which now, you know, is going against everything that they've done since the end of the Cold War. Three, that this is a result of long-term trade distortions, which are going to be unwound somehow. And fourth, that allies might not put up with it for too much longer. I think this is actually pretty important news.
I'll just say two things quickly in response to that. The first one is that I don't think the Trump policy is yet clear. There was a news report, I think this week, that John Paulson, who's a big hedge fund mogul and one of the big backers of Trump, is angling for the Treasury Secretary position. And he's taking the position that the US should not decouple from China. He's trying to wind back that rhetoric. I think there are people around Trump discussing this. I think that the fact that multipolarity in a few other places are some of the only people pushing back on this, frankly, sorry to get such a big head, but really there is not much out there in the way of pushback on this. But I think that those couple of voices out in the wilderness there who are saying, this is getting a bit crazy, I think they're being listened to and I think it's being discussed in private. So I just say that and highlight the fact that John Paulson is sounding very multipolarity-ish and he's running, trying to get the Treasury Secretary position. The second thing I'd say is in response to if America does actually start pulling up the drawbridges here, which they might do. Again, on the Trump thing, I'm only speculating and putting out the chatter. But the issue with this is actually that America may already be slipping into a kind of a structural inflationary bias in their economy. So data came out this week on overnight index swaps, which basically show where markets think relative interest rates are going to go. And what they're showing is that the Federal Reserve interest rate is expected to be significantly higher now over the next few years than the ECB, than the European Central Bank. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it means that the Federal Reserve aren't going to be able to cut rates because inflation's ticking up again in the US, but the ECB will because the inflation's falling. Now, that's very surprising because the ECB is dealing with a massive energy shock, something fundamental, a fundamental structural shift. Took place in Europe, which was cheap gas dried up. And that remains the case in Europe today. And in spite of that, they absorbed that shock and prices then came under control. In America, that hasn't happened. They didn't face a shock of similar magnitude, but inflation is sticking around. Now, I think there's a couple of reasons for that, but one of them might be all this trade interference. This is exactly what you'd expect. If you cut off goods that you can't produce yourself, you're raising prices. And I wonder if that the Biden administration and all these policymakers and all these political strategists worry day in, day out about inflation this, inflation that. When's the Fed going to get inflation under control? Blah, blah, blah. And no one sat them down and said, all that trade stuff you're talking about is creating structural inflation that the central bank can't deal with. And the last thing I'd say about that is, you want to go look at the polls about how annoyed Americans are about the inflation situation. It's absolutely visceral. If you build this kind of inflation into the American economy on an ongoing basis, let's say over the next 10 years, as you do these, frankly, I think, self-defeating trade policies, the people will go crazy. I don't know if the economy will hold up. I mean, famously, we've had on the show Malcolm Chayuna, and we've discussed his hamburger theory of history. He also has a hamburger theory of political stability in America, and it runs something like this. If your Big Mac ends up costing too much, if your grilled meat ends up costing too much, you might lose it at some stage. And I think there's a real risk of them doing that. And no one, absolutely no one that I can see, is sitting down these policymakers and explaining to them that the inflation that they're so very concerned about isn't just about Federal Reserve policy, isn't just about Putin and Ukraine. It's also about these very trade policies that they seem to promote over and over again.
Very briefly on that, I'm sorry to add another footnote to your footnote, another epilogue to your epilogue. It wasn't just Paulson, but another grand poobah of Wall Street, Jamie Dimon, came out. And I think at Davos, he was asked about Trump, and the interviewer was obviously, you know, lobbing up a softball for Dimon to whack out the park. But much to everyone's criticism, Dimon didn't spit poison at Trump. He actually said, Trump wouldn't be too bad. You know, a lot of Trump's instincts and ideas were pretty good. So I don't think it's, you know, just people like Paulson who are kind of softening to Trump and maybe trying to get in Trump's ear. But on that matter, it went largely unnoticed. I think I'm right in saying, I should probably have this in front of me, but you just saying it has reminded me and I haven't had time to pull up the story. But Donald Trump, I believe, or someone close to him, did actually suggest that rather than putting tariffs on Chinese cars, they might offer, you know, a Trump administration might offer China the opportunity to open up electric car factories in the United States and battery factories in the United States. That might be an option. That might be a sensible way of going about things, I would have thought. So, yeah, I think that you're right, Philip. There might, you know, it might not be that Trump is the kind of, you know, the arch protectionist in this sense. And I think this is a story that, yeah, I mean, there might be some various avenues that it could go yet, although I still stand by that the trend is toward far further and further protectionism.
Enter the Draghi.
Mario Draghi made a big speech. It was published just yesterday. The text of the speech was published on the website of a group, d'études géopolitiques, which is a European geopolitics website. Draghi made what seems to have been and has been reported in some places as a kind of a mea culpa, a rollback on his on the policies of austerity in Europe that he supported for the last, you know, 15 years or even 20 years or so since the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. And a lot of the left wing was saying, wow, finally, Draghi's admitting that he's wrong. But what he actually said wasn't that. It was actually something far more interesting. So what did he say? He first started off with a quote from Paul Krugman saying that nations who focus on competitiveness have, quotation marks, a dangerous obsession. This was in 1994, before Krugman became very famous. And Draghi said that the policies that we in Europe have followed since the global financial crisis seem to have been designed to prove Krugman right. So what policies were they? So, you know, we need a flashback to understand this. During the global financial crisis, people will remember that several European countries, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, had really huge problems and could have gone fairly close if unaddressed. Towards sovereign default, I would have thought. Now, all these problems are different. Greece was different to Spain's, was different to Italy's, was different to Portugal's, was different to Ireland. But anyway, the policies that the European Union undertook to cope with these were essentially, I think some debt was restructured, but mostly additional loans were given. The ECB propped up the bonds to stop them becoming, you know, too pricey for governments to raise debt. And at the same time, enforced a range of kind of austerity, a range of fiscal retrenchment policies on these individual nations to kind of to squeeze down on wages until those countries regained competitiveness and were able essentially to export their way out of trouble. But of course, that led to years and decades of kind of grinding unemployment and grinding stagnation until essentially the back of labor was broken and they could force down wages for long enough. And this affected things like consumption demand. It affected things like training. It affected things like the, you know, industry and the jobs available within the economy. It didn't go well. And what is Draghi saying here? Well, we couldn't have designed a policy to prove Krugman more right. Is it a mea culpa? No, because then he goes on to say, but the key issue is not that competitiveness is a flawed concept, i.e. we weren't wrong to focus on trying to regain competitiveness by squeezing down on wages as the main focus. I continue with the quote. It is that Europe has had the wrong focus. And then he says, we've turned inwards, trying to gain competitiveness ourselves and against each other. And we've not looked outwards. We've not looked to the world economy. And unfortunately, Unfortunately, other people weren't playing by the rules. He says that other countries have not abided by the rules-based order, whereas we poor Europeans were being honest and decent and playing by the rules. Everyone else wasn't, and that's what really has screwed us. And here he actually criticizes both China and the US. He says that China has been trying to capture and internalize every part of the supply chain for advanced technologies and green technologies. And it's developed because of that, I quote, overcapacity. People will remember that from Mrs. Yellen. But he also goes on to criticize the US. He says that the US is using a large-scale industrial policy to attract high-value domestic manufacturing capacity within its borders, including that of European firms, note that, while also using protectionism, that's a word for tariffs, to shut out competitiveness. And it's also been deploying, I quote here, deploying its geopolitical power to reorient and secure supply chains. So what Draghi's doing here is basically saying that, as I said, we Europeans have been playing by the rules and we've been taken advantage of. Other people have been playing a competitive game when we didn't even know a game was going on. And he goes on to suggest a whole range of, in very broad terms, solutions to this. But I think this is very interesting because this is based on Draghi's report into European competitiveness in a new world. And the report is going to be called Radical Change is What is Needed. And for people who don't understand the way the European Union works, it's a bit sclerotic and it's a bit slow. But it's very good when it comes to detail. It's very good when it comes to legal detail. And once they get their teeth into a bureaucratic issue, once they get their teeth into an issue of regulation, they don't let go ever. That's it. The teeth just keep sinking further and further in. So if they start getting their teeth into Europe's place in the world, trade policy, industrial policy, you can expect at the end of that, after a whole bunch of, political and diplomatic wrangling behind the scenes and fights and, stilettos through the ribs that we don't see, you can expect something slow and, it'll take too long at the end of that. And I think this might be the first sign that Europe might be trying to reorient itself.
Yeah, but toward what? I mean, when I hear this stuff...
Well, that's the question, Philip, is toward what? I mean, it goes back to... I mean, it's clear that they're starting to think about this now. This is something that they're thinking... I mean, they're clearly saying, look, the US and China are eating our lunch here, and they're both doing it. It's not just China, but it's the US as well. And they're clearly saying, what are we going to do? Now, I'm sure Draghi will give the kind of the consummate Euro technocrats answers to that. Like, even now, he won't forsake the disastrous austerity problems, which have been part of the problem here. But as you and I know, there is a battle at the moment between the Atlanticists and the autonomists. And maybe this is an opportunity, this debate, which is now clearly happening within the EU, is an opportunity for the autonomists to try by hook or by crook to shift EU policy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the optimistic reading. It won't come from Draghi. It won't come from that generation. I mean, what you describe is, like the South Park underpass names. It's like, we have all these problems and this and this and this, and then we're going to have a solution. It's rubbish. Nonsense. The reality is that actually the debates that Draghi is referring to, I remember them very well back in the day. It's kind of why I became an economist. I was involved in some of them. Those debates are dead as a doornail for now. Because, look, to simplify it an awful lot, but it's not really that misleading. Europe, after their crisis, had one of two paths to take. They could try and turn the entire EU into Germany. That's a kind of hyper-competitive trade surplus bloc with slightly lower wages or lower living standards. Or they could, and then focus on, being a great manufacturer and so on and maintaining, leading the world in that. Or they could go down the path where they'd subsidize consumption in the poorer countries to absorb the products from Germany. And this would probably hold down competitiveness slightly on the global stage. They went with option one. Was Draghi a supporter of option one? Actually, probably not. I think Draghi personally would have preferred option two. Now, of course, that those words never came out of his mouth because he's a politician. He's a politician first and an economist second. But I think he's been chomping at the bit to stick it to Wolfgang Schäuble and the Germans and so on. And he's venting here. This is catharsis. This is Freudian stuff. But this is kind of, I mean, I don't want to be mean about it. It's an old man reliving his glory days, right? These questions aren't relevant anymore. The fact of the matter is that when there was two options on the table back in 2012, 2013, 2014, both of those options worked. Now, they worked in different ways, okay? One of them gave you a vision of Europe like Germany, which would have higher unemployment structurally. It would have lower wages structurally. It would have lower consumption. But it ran a trade surplus. And guess what? The EU ran a trade surplus after these policies were placed. Option two would have given you a different type of Europe. One more favored by Italians, left-wingers, Mario Draghi, etc., etc., etc. The point is, though, both of these models would have worked in their respective ways. They just would have had different outcomes, okay? Now we're in a situation where nothing works. Absolutely nothing works. You can't do the competitiveness one because energy prices are too high, and you can't do the subsidization model that Draghi is now championing and probably has always wanted to champion, because guess what? The production isn't going to be there anymore. Or you're going to raise the tariff drawbridges and prices are going to rise enormously. And you can pump up wages. You can engage in higher wages in the peripheral country. You can let Italy spend like a drunken sailor and absorb all the surplus capacity. Oh, wait, what surplus capacity? There isn't going to be any surplus capacity. It's just going to be expensive stuff made in Germany that's not competitive on the world stage, and tariffs are going to block you from getting the cheap Chinese stuff. So this is just theater. It's absolute theater. There are a bunch of people who have been discussing all these matters over the years and thinking that they're the most important thing in the world. And now, in February of 2022, they were woken up to the fact that none of that stuff was important in the long term. Really, to Europe's future, none of that stuff was important. This conflict that had been simmering away in eastern Ukraine was the most important thing for their entire project's future, and they paid no attention to it. And when they did pay attention to it, they thought that's perfectly under control. Frau Merkel's got that under control. The Americans have that under control, and it will never go anywhere else. And then when it did go somewhere else, they backed a war. They backed a war that they're now going to lose. And that's every single one of that generation. They can't sum up. And so I don't mean to be cruel about this, because I actually don't mind Mario Draghi as much as some people. But there is somebody who cannot face the reality of what Europe is facing then, which frankly is catastrophic. Not just the deindustrialization, not just the high energy prices, but facing then a destroyed state and a lost war on their eastern flank. Absolute catastrophe. Catastrophe, not having enough spending to put into the military budget as the US pulls back its defensive lines from Europe. Catastrophe. And this crowd have nothing to say about it because they are focused on these old issues. So what do? When they have to go up on a podium or when they have to produce a paper, they produce this. They produce something that's 10 years old that has no relevance to today. And here's the worst part. When they encounter people who do have something to say about these issues, who do have something to say about both the economy and the problems with defense policy and the problems with the geopolitical situation in the east of Europe, when they encounter those people, they shout them down. They call them Putin supporters. They call them names because they can't hear it. And so these are dead men walking. These are corpses. These are zombies. And whatever comes into Europe, whatever comes in to solve this problem, mark my words, will not come from that generation, and it will not come from that group of people. They will go to their graves debating what they were debating in 2012.